Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, youth sports, how one parent is warning others to back off. But first, Congress is back from spring break. On the agenda, credit cards. The House and Senate have each passed versions of a credit card bill of rights for cardholders. And while lawmakers work on reconciling the two bills, the White House plans on meeting with credit card company executives later this week. Let's start today with Binyamin Appelbaum, national banking reporter for The Washington Post. Binya, how unusual is this? White House economic advisor Lawrence Summers himself meeting with execs this Thursday.
It's pretty unusual for the White House to take this level of interest in such a specific part of the banking industry, to convene a meeting of senior executives at the White House to talk about this type of fine-grained policy. We don't see this very often.
Well, what do Congress and the White House have a problem with?
There is a lot of concern and anger among the constituents of members of Congress about the way that the credit card industry charges, the way that it discloses those charges, the way basically that it treats its customers. And this anger has been rising for years. And there is a consensus in Congress that now is the time to do something about it. The Federal Reserve imposed restrictions on the industry that address many of these practices but don't take effect until July 2010. And Congress wants change to happen more quickly.
Well, and let's be more specific about some of the things that are happening. We understand cards are raising interest rates, you know, arbitrarily on already existing balances.
Yeah, some of the things that happen that really get people upset is you've borrowed money on your credit card. You know what the interest rate is, the interest rate that you agreed to with the credit card company. Let's say it's 12%. And then something else happens in your life, something totally unrelated to that credit card. You miss a payment on a car or you're late in paying a different credit card. And the company jacks your interest rate up to 29%. And all of a sudden, you're paying massively more than you understood. Or another classic example is that you make a payment on part of your balance, and it's applied to the part of your balance that's least helpful to you. Perhaps it's applied to a balance transfer that you did for free. And instead of paying that down, you end up paying down the portion that's least helpful to you, and they keep on charging you massive interest on the rest of your account.
Right. Also, giving customers little time between billing and requiring payment. These are different things we're seeing. And many different banks, Capital One, Bank of America, Citi, have all raised interest rates or cut credit lines for some of their customers. And many of these banks are receiving bailout money. Is that part of the anger?
I think that it is. I think it's also part of the leverage. The White House sees an opportunity here to get these banks to perhaps accept measures that they would have been more reluctant to accept. But the industry is really back on its heels right now. It's dependent on the government. It's already under intense public scrutiny. And I think proponents of these changes believe that if there was ever a time to put these measures through, this is it.
Well, what are banks saying?
The banks have two big concerns about this. The first is they say that if the rules are changed in this way, it will be harder for them to provide credit to more marginal customers, lower income families, people with a history of credit problems, people who already have a difficult time getting access to credit may find it even harder to borrow money because the industry won't be able to offer it to them. The other thing that they say is that on the one hand, the government is engaged in this massive effort to restore their profitability, to nurse them back to health, and here comes the government with its other hand, essentially taking money out of their pockets. And they say basically, you know, you're making your own bailout more expensive.
Well, and what's been the political discussion about this? Lawrence Summers, who, as we said, is meeting with the industry leaders on Thursday, has also said that Americans need to save more. But that pitch would seem to be a Republican argument, and changes would be seen as government interference with business. So how are Republicans responding to this idea of reforming the credit card industry?
There was a lot of initial opposition. There have been bills before both the House and the Senate. The Senate bill passed the Senate Banking Committee very narrowly with a lot of Republican opposition to it. And the House bill has broader support. But in both cases, there's been a lot of concern exactly about government meddling, about the notion that the government is better equipped to determine how an industry should operate. A lot of concern about restricting access to credit for consumers who need it. So there's a difficult political battle ahead here. There's going to be a lot of opposition to this.
And given that, any idea how quickly there might be changes or if they, you know, we can be certain they'd come about?
You know, there is a very different political climate at the moment. A year ago, this was unthinkable, and we know that because it was tried and it failed. Since then, Democrats have solid majorities in both houses of Congress. There's a president who's enjoying a lot of power at the moment, and he all of a sudden seems determined to push for this. The odds actually look pretty good for something to get through.
Binyamin Appelbaum, national banking reporter for The Washington Post. Binya, thank you.
My pleasure.
Half Pint Baseball with big league excitement and enthusiasm at Williamsport. Final game of the Little League World Series.
Since Little League was founded in 1939, it's thrived. Last year, over 70 million people watched the final World Series game on TV. But that's exactly why the game's founder, the late Carl Stoetz, became its biggest critic. He feared the pressure on kids would break them, and they are breaking. There were 3.5 million youth sports injuries in 2003. ACL tears, swimmers with shoulders hanging like spaghetti, eating disorders. And our next guest, a father who also coached his own child in Little League, says the irony is many kids are playing so hard to get into pro sports or get college scholarships, but instead they're burning out before they get to high school. Mark Hyman's new book is called Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Your book is part confessional. Your son Ben was a baseball player. You had great hopes for him. He was a pitcher. You seem like a very sensible person, but you saw firsthand how you corrupted into one of those parents who, at one point, you sort of pushed to have your son play injured.
It's not something that I'm proud about talking about, but in writing this book, it was something that I had to talk about. When Ben was 14, he came to me at the end of a baseball season and said, you know what, my shoulder is really tired. It bothered me in the last game, and I don't know what to do about it. And if I had been thinking and if I had been acting as a parent rather than a coach, I would have known exactly what to do, which is to say, your season is over and, see you in the spring on the baseball field. But instead, I kind of found a way to rationalize that he should be pitching in the next game because it was a playoff game and winning was very important to me. I wanted to win because I wanted to prove that I could outcoach the gastroenterologist who was the coach of the other team. I thought winning would improve the way the other parents on the team felt about me. I liked the idea of a trophy over the fireplace in our house. And I was thinking about all the wrong things. And, after he threw a couple of pitches in that game and I saw how injured he really was, I took him out, and it was a turning point for me. I really woke up that day.
But eventually, after overusing that arm for so many years, Ben had something happen that happens to many young athletes. Tell us about that.
When he was a senior in high school, he ruptured a ligament in his throwing elbow. It's a classic overuse injury.
In fact, it's so classic that when the player Tommy John had a surgery to correct it, they now call that surgery the Tommy John, and kids regularly talk about it.
That's right. You can have this kind of ghoulish operation that requires a tendon be harvested from the opposite wrist, transferred to the elbow, and then the surgeon drills holes in the upper and lower bones of the elbow and laces the tendon through those holes, kind of like tying a shoelace, and restores the elbow in that way. And that's what my son Ben had.
This is surgery. It carries risks. And you discovered it's become almost a status symbol. And some kids are getting it not only to restore their pitching arm to what it was, but there's a misconception that they'll get it and be better, when in fact they may not ever play again.
What surgeons will tell you is that many of the patients they're seeing have very limited futures in baseball. It's a very difficult rehabilitation. It takes 18 months to really fully recover. And by the time the patient is fully recovered, there really is no baseball career to return to.
Well, that's Little League. But let's move on to some other sports. I mean, you write about a mother named Marion who didn't want to give her name because she talked about realizing that her children were in a swim club where the coach constantly measured the swimmer's body fat. At practice, he'd bring out a pair of calipers and move from girl to girl, pinching their arms to see if they had fat. He drew blood, all without talking to the parents.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? And it ended with this 24-hour marathon swim where they were going to be swimming, I think it was 3 hours on and then 3 hours off for 24 hours. And, the total distance, something approaching the circumference of Manhattan Island. And the mother went along because her daughter was so taken with the idea and wanted to participate.
But then shortly after, the daughter's elbow blows. She gets orthopedic surgery, goes to practice every day with a bowl in her backpack that she can throw up into.
Really a terrible ending to that story. And the mom still felt that she didn't want to insist that her daughter quit competitive swimming. She wanted it to be her daughter's decision, and ultimately her daughter did decide that she was going to leave swimming.
Talk a little bit about that, because you talk to doctors and sports psychologists who say that very often an injury is a sign that a kid just doesn't want to do this anymore.
I spoke to a number of physicians, and often it's that the child really doesn't want to return to sports, and the injury is a way for them to stay on the sidelines for a while or even indefinitely. Some children are so concerned about disappointing their parents that they just don't want to tell them, that they'd rather be hanging out with their friends or playing video games or even doing their homework than playing sports.
Some of the other cases you write about, a girl named Rachel who said softball was a boot camp, and that her dad, when she was 9, made her run around a school if she had an errant throw, and at one point swung a metal bat at a post and said that's what he felt like doing to her. A kindergartner skipping meals to cut weight. He was a little wrestler, and he revealed in conversation to friends that he was trying to drop weight before a meet. And he's 5.
There are parents who believe that their kids' sports careers are somehow a reflection of them. That's when crazy things start to happen. And the story you mentioned about the wrestler is I think, one of the crazier things in the book. I mean, it sounds absolutely nuts.
Yeah. Well, and it's probably extreme. And what are you going to say to the people that we're going to hear from who say, sports changed my children's life for the better, gave our family something to rally around? For instance, Michael McLaughlin, who runs the Skywalkers lacrosse program, who runs kids up and down flights of stairs until many of them get sick. There are going to be parents who went to that, you know, program and said, fantastic, you know, gave my child discipline.
You know, it's not a career path. 95% of kids who play high school sports never play 1 minute in college. And professional sports, I mean, you might as well buy a lottery ticket if your expectation is that you're going to raise a professional athlete. So for the vast majority of us, this is not about, you know, climbing the ladder of sports success to college. It doesn't happen. Less than 1% of kids on college campuses are there with college athletic scholarships. Mm-hmm. Less than 1%. I mean, those are pretty bad odds.
You quote a college coach, I think it was, who was sitting across from a parent who was saying, you've got to give my kid a scholarship. I've invested so much in him. And the coach said, what is he, a mutual fund?
Well, this is one of the issues. We're spending so much. The youth sports economy is in the billions. And depending on how ambitious you are as a parent and how talented your kid is, you can spend tens of thousands of dollars a year. There's an academy in Florida, the IMG Academy, which is basically a pre-professional school for kids who hope to play in college and maybe the pros. And there are kids there who, with the coaching and the room and board, their tuition bills are over $100,000 a year.
Mm. And psychologists told you if a child's identity is so derived from one sport and they don't make it, it's crushing. Kids are quitting school teams because they think colleges only look at club sports. Mark Hyman is author of Until It Hurts. When we come back, the story of the other Phelps swimmer, Mark's sister. And later, speaking of Till It Hurts, the Boston Marathon. Back in a minute. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Some parents cheering at a weekend youth soccer game here in the Boston area. Positive reinforcement, that's great. But why are some towns calling for Silent Parent Weekend, handing out lollipops to keep mom and dad quiet? Journalist Mark Hyman investigates what happens when parents push kids too far in his new book, Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. And Mark, you write that some parents cut back on groceries to pay for gear and practice. Tell us more.
There's one gentleman I spoke to in Atlanta who has a son who is a very talented golfer, and he told me without hesitation that he had allowed his family's health insurance policy to lapse for a while in order to be able to pay for his son's lessons and, you know, the other expenses that go along with having a kid who's a top-notch golfer.
Well, and in some of their eyes is a top-notch golfer named Tiger Woods. And you remind us that Tiger Woods was brought by his dad onto the Mike Douglas show?
Yeah.
When he was 2 years old.
I refer to it as the tiger track. And I think this is one of the big changes we've seen in youth sports in the present generation. Kids are starting much earlier than they ever did. Now it's common for kids to be involved in organized sports at 3 or 4. There's one national soccer program that starts before kids are 2. And then there's also this very significant trend towards specialization. So you have children who are playing or practicing or being tutored in the same sport year-round. They're doing the same things over and over and over again, and that's why we have an epidemic, really, of overuse injuries.
Well, and then there's also, as we keep going from the physical to the emotional, they also have, if that's their identity, they are set up for a bigger sense of disappointment if they don't go to the top. And you write about Whitney Phelps, the little-known sister of Michael Phelps, the winningest Olympian of all time. At one point, Whitney was the family star in the pool. What happened to her?
Whitney Phelps is a couple of years older than Michael. And as I write in the book, for a long time, when people in Baltimore talked about a Phelps swimmer who was destined for the Olympics, it wasn't Michael Phelps, it was Whitney. Very talented and very driven. But by age 10, she was having pain, symptoms of overuse injuries. And as she explained to me, by age 12, it was sometimes difficult for her to finish workouts and even to stand because of pain in her back. But in part because she was so driven, she was reluctant to share that information with her mom and with her coach. And the adults around her also were very invested in her success. So no one really saved Whitney. She didn't qualify for the Olympics in 1996 and had a very difficult time emotionally dealing with that.
And dealing with her brother's success.
She's very honest about saying for a time she couldn't really enjoy his success the way she probably should have.
Overall, in reading your book, we get the sense that there's a serious problem here, and some people are trying to make some changes. Tick through some of the things that towns and schools and parents and rec leagues are doing to change the way kids are involved in sports.
There are some positive things going on, and I mentioned some programs in the book that I think are models in the sense that they put the interests of the kids first, and that's such an important element. One program that I speak about is called the Wildcat Baseball League in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The parents are very peripheral to this league. They can come to games. They're not really encouraged to. They're not coaches. The coaches are teachers in the community, sometimes older kids, athletes who are, maybe high school athletes. And the coaches are not assigned to individual teams. They're assigned to games. So you might have two coaches. One is the bench coach for the game. The other is the umpire. And they're not invested in the outcome of the game because they're not assigned to a particular team for the entire year. And so they can concentrate on developing skills and self-esteem and those qualities rather than, who's going to be the champion of the league. There's a program here in Baltimore called Athletes and Authors, which is basically a summer camp. During the day, they have 4 or 5 scheduled sports activities, and they also have a language arts component. There are a group of parents in Minnesota who have taken a pledge that their children will not play competitive sports on Sundays.
I've got it right here. I just want to read it. Mm-hmm. The pledge reads, "I do not want my child to be overscheduled. Even high school and collegiate varsity athletes traditionally take Sundays off from practices and games, and I know that cultural change towards more balanced living requires a unified stand by many parents." And they sign that.
I don't think there are millions of parents who've signed up for this yet, because there are lots of pressures the other way. If you want your child to be, playing on the travel team, it's difficult to take a pledge like that and make it stand up. But there are small efforts like this around the country that indicate that there's some sentiment that we've really gone too far and we have to take a step back.
Here's some of the other programs. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the Baton Rouge Soccer Association is experimenting with silent weekends, to get the parents to stop yelling at kids during games. Central Pennsylvania Youth Soccer League forces parents and coaches into silence by giving them a truckload of lollipops. They passed out 30,000, you write, in 2007. That's their silent soccer weekend. In Duval County, Florida, parents, players, and coaches are required to sign a sportsmanship contract. In Naples, Florida, calling out to a player during a game can cost a parent $45.
Robin, what's so interesting about this is all of these rules that you cite, they're rules that we're making to rein ourselves in. These are not rules about children at all. They're rules about monitoring and managing the behavior of adults.
Well, by the way, Mark, you said your son is 21 now. What kind of conversation have you had with him? You, as a coach, had him play injured. Have you apologized to him? How did that go?
It's a great question. I think Ben appreciates that I made my mistakes, but he knows that I did lots of positive things in youth sports as well. And when I showed him the completed manuscript of the book, his reaction was to say to me, "You know, Dad, get over it. You know, it's over, and you did make a mistake, but life goes on." And he's back playing baseball and happy that he had the surgery and happy that he's able to play again.
Mark Hyman, sports writer for Business Week, also author of the new book, Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. You can learn more by going to our website, hereandnow.org. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, and still ahead, an American woman gives the ultimate winner a run for her money in the Boston Marathon. That's after the news, here and now. In Turkey, a designer best known for creating stylish bars and restaurants for the jet set is about to complete a radically different project, a mosque. It's being dubbed a monument to modern Islam, both for its style and because for the first time in Istanbul, the mosque designer is a woman. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford sent this report.
So it was like this in the beginning.
One of Turkey's best-known designers explains her latest project in a porta cabin in eastern Istanbul.
And the minarets were not up. This is very traditional.
A tall blonde in a flamboyant silk overcoat, Zeynep Fadilioğlu is renowned for her similarly extravagant bars, restaurants and nightclubs. Now, she's the first ever woman in Turkey to design a mosque.
Well, we're the first outside team to be allowed into the mosque to actually see what's going on here. And it's really difficult to find words to describe it. It's unlike any mosque I've ever seen before. Just starting from the colours, there's turquoise and coral pink and gold and silver and cream. There's glass on all four sides and the sunlight streaming in through the cast iron screens on the outside.
There are more women in Zeynep's team putting the finishing touches to a vast chandelier made from plexiglass and strung with dangling glass beads that sparkle in the sunlight. It's inscribed in silver with a verse from the Quran. The whole mosque is a similar blend of traditional and modern, meant to break the mould in a city that's seen little innovation in mosque design for centuries. Zeynep admits that goal has given her sleepless nights.
We consulted art historians and theologians at each and every stop. We didn't want to offend anybody with anything that we did, but we realized that people in higher thinking of Islam were much more open-minded than my mind. Everything that I kept on asking, they said, why not, of course.
I'm just climbing up now to the balcony at the back of the mosque with a view over the chandelier. And this is where the women will pray. And some mosques here in Turkey, the women are behind a curtain squashed at the back. But Zeynep's made a specific point to keep this place as attractive and as comfortable a place to pray as anywhere for the men.
I don't think there is any differentiation between a man and a woman in Islam. I mean, if you go to Quran, there is for sure not. That's tradition. Looking from a woman's point of view, designing a mosque might have brought in another understanding that women are also in the society and Islam has given them the right value.
A trip to the opposite bank of the Bosphorus reveals how radical a step all this really is. With its soft music and plush furnishings, this restaurant is a previous Zeynep Fadilioğlu design, a favourite hangout of the Istanbul secular jet set. Bottles of spirits line the polished wood bar, and images of scantily clad women adorn the walls. But the designer behind all this sees nothing unusual in applying her talents to a very different canvas.
I've been raised as a Muslim, and I believe I'm a good Muslim. It's not like I'm coming from another world and designing a mosque or something. I think a designer could design a lot of different things.
Devout Muslim or otherwise, most Turks seem to agree. Back in the garden of the mosque, there are two men digging a grave. It's a plot for the family who commissioned the groundbreaking design. It's nice enough, one of the diggers tells me, pausing to survey the space-age domes in front of him. It's no problem for me that a woman designed it. That's how she makes her living, and this is how I make mine. In fact, in secular Turkey, this monument to modern Islam has gone down so well, the country's first ever female mosque designer has already been asked to work on another.
That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford reporting from Istanbul, Turkey. Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, recession television from Ugly Betty to 30 Rock. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Columbine High School is closed today to mark the 10th anniversary of the massacre that killed 13 and injured 23, and it's probably safe to say, emotionally wounded the entire country. At the time, it was the worst school shooting in American history, and even as it was taking place, a set of myths took hold, that it was carried out by bullied boys, that they were targeting blacks, gays, Christians, jocks. We now know the killers were not bullied. One was a ruthless sociopath and the other a depressive who had fallen under a spell. They didn't seem to be targeting anyone in particular, and before the shooting, a family had approached the Littleton, Colorado police with concerns about one of the shooters. That policeman was pulled off the case and given another assignment. Joseph Lieberman, not the senator, but the author of School Shootings, What Every Parent and Educator Needs to Know to Protect Our Children, says today should be a day to mourn the victims, but also honor them by congratulating ourselves on the progress we've made in advancing school safety. And instead, you say what, Joe?
Well, I'm saying that since Columbine happened 10 years ago, there's been more than 500 deaths of faculty, students, administrators around the world, and it's no longer just a U.S. problem, so we have to look at the bigger picture.
Well, we want to be quick to note, as you do, that around 8 kids under 19 are killed every day in America by gun violence. That's a classroom of kids every 3 days. And it's estimated that the chance of dying in an American school from any cause is 1 in 2 million. I mean, just, it's so rare. But you say you're not taking any chances because your own daughter has sort of an association, an odd association, with two separate incidences. Tell us about those, one in Japan and one in Oregon.
Well, that's correct. We were living in Japan, and I was teaching at university there, and we were thinking about a private school. She didn't get in there. We decided to move back to the U.S. and then move to Eugene, Oregon, just across the highway from Springfield, where a major school shooting had happened 1 year earlier in 1998. About a year after we moved, we heard about this event in Japan where a psychopath went to a school and he killed 8 children. That was the school our daughter was going to go to. And then after I wrote my first book on this subject, she was at a school where a young 15-year-old showed up with a couple of stolen guns, and that school shooting was prevented.
Because this young man was disarmed at the school.
Right. He was caught on the campus grounds, but the school was locked down within 25 seconds because the assistant principal had a plan in place. When I went to meet him later, I said, "How did you do that?" And he said, "Well, partly it's because of your book." And I was surprised. I didn't even know he had my book. And he said, "Yes, I read it 3 times.
So this is pretty chilling for you. One daughter who's associated with 2 schools, you know, at which there are attacks. One is stopped and the other leads to not a gun killing, but a knife killing of students in Japan. Well, tell us a little bit about what that principal is talking about. You say that there's something like an identifiable psychological profile of these attackers. Outline some of the 15 warning signs that you talk about.
The prerequisite for almost every school shooter in history is that they're suicidal. In being suicidal, it's likely that they're depressed, and it's likely that they have been given some sorts of medication for depression, which brings up a whole other chapter on what effects those medications might have. The other thing is, of course, they need access to weapons. But as we see in fairly gun-free societies such as Japan and China, even without a gun, people will try to do these things. Yeah. So those are a few of the signs. But as we saw by looking at the background of Seung-hee Cho at Virginia Tech, for example, they exhibit a lot of other signs, violent writings and things like that.
You know, this is particularly heartbreaking. The same as the situation in Columbine, where the Brown family had gone to police in Littleton and with fears that one of the eventual killers was going to kill their child. And there was a whole profile put together, and then the policeman was taken off the case. I know you've been working with schools, including the University of Oregon. What can a school do to keep track of kids without kind of crossing over the line into privacy issues?
That line that would be crossed is when privacy issues contradict public safety. So early intervention with students who exhibit antisocial behavior or tendencies toward violence is taken much more seriously now. That's what the UO Emergency Management Program is about. And they're also trying to do not just the technological systems, but also training for how to respond when they do get an alert.
Well, alerts are one thing. A lot of schools have the cell phone alert set up. But how do schools identify these kids in advance? And, you know, even back to the high school in Eugene, Oregon, how did they know? How do you know when someone's coming?
Well, in the case of what happened at my daughter's school, the sister of the potential shooter was concerned and knew he had stolen a gun and knew he had a grudge, and she called up the school. And in fact, 90% of prevented school shootings are because other students or peers of the potential shooter have talked to an adult. The ones that aren't prevented are the ones where people have said, well, I thought he was only joking, or I never thought it could happen here. And increasingly, we realize it can happen here. It can happen in a little Amish community. It can happen in any small town or even a larger city.
Well, and you mentioned the suicidal tendencies of the shooters, and you make an analogy with suicide bombers.
Explain that. And the fact is, in recent years, more and more school shooters have been recording themselves on videotape first and now on YouTube. So what they're trying to do is very similar to what the suicide bombers do for Al-Qaeda, for example, where they make a video before they go out to die. And it's pretty much a suicide note, but now it's been made public. The interesting thing about the European school shooters, where most of the shootings are occurring these days, is most of them do their suicide note online in English.
Obviously, they want to reach the English-speaking media as well, the big media, and get the big splash.
Right, they know
splash.
English is the world language, right. And they just want it to be out there.
Well, it's because of this you have a very provocative thought. You say that pictures of the dead shooters should be published. The Inquirer paid for photos of the two Columbine shooters. They were very graphic pictures. There's a huge hue and cry about it. A police officer also published pictures of the shooting in Cleveland, Ohio at Success Tech Academy back in 2007 and put those online. He got in a lot of trouble. Grisly graphic photos. Why do you believe they should be published?
Well, because the contradiction to that is what students and kids are seeing on the internet in video games. Not to say that the gritty video games aren't pretty bloody and graphic, but they're not real. They're virtual reality. And they're getting in their minds a kind of image of death as being a kind of a glamorous thing. It goes back to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where the last scene, they go out with guns blazing. And I think a lot of the school shooters imagine themselves as the hero of their own movie.
And you say that these grisly images would contradict the other ones that are on the web of some of these shooters posing triumphantly with their guns. It's the same as the suicide bombers who take photos of themselves.
Exactly.
You know, and it looks very noble and heroic. But you say what if they were to see?
Well, real death is very ugly. And the school shooters who have not killed themselves, the ones that have gone to prison, have a very different story to tell. They say again and again they didn't realize the reality of it, what it would really be like. And in the middle of it, they're getting a kind of a pleasure out of it. A lot of them are smiling or laughing as they do the shooting. But once it's all over and reality kicks in, it's a very different story.
Joseph Lieberman, author of School Shootings, What Every Parent and Educator Needs to Know to Protect Our Children. Joseph, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And just a reminder, you can always listen to Here and Now stream live. You can download a podcast. You can click on Contact Us and send a note. We read them all. That's at our website, hereandnow.org. Back in a minute, who won the Boston Marathon? You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Well, today's women's race at the Boston Marathon was a thriller. American Kara Goucher leading almost all of the way, but then what happened? Alex Ashlock at the finish line, what happened?
Well, Robin, Kara Goucher decided to push the pace with about 5 miles left in the race. She said she was worried about it coming down to a huge pack of women, so it came down to three. Down Boylston Street, Selena Kosgei outkicked the woman from Ethiopia, Dire Tune, last year's winner. Selena Kosgei outkicked her, winning by only 1 second. So this finish today was even closer than last year's finish in the women's race. Kara Goucher wound up third.
And on the men's side?
On the men's side, Dariba Murga of Ethiopia ran away with this race today. Ryan Hall, the American, finished third. Murga, in the Olympics last year, lost the bronze medal in the final lap on the track of the race, so it was a sweet victory for him today. Daniel Rono of Kenya finished second.
And the wheelchair racer, South African Ernst van Dijk, his record eighth win. And on the women's side?
On the women's side, Wakako Tachida of Japan, she won for the third time. And just another word about Ernst van Dijk, an amazing performance again. His eighth overall title, tying Gene Driscoll with eight overall wins. Those are the most victories of any Boston Marathon champion.
Here now is Alex Ashlock at the finish line at the Boston Marathon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, every year the Boston Athletic Association pays tribute to past Boston Marathon champs. Lorraine Moeller of New Zealand was one of the athletes honored Saturday. She won the Boston Marathon in 1984, later won a bronze at the 1992 Women's Olympic Marathon. On Saturday, Moeller praised the woman she says paved the way for her, Catherine Switzer.
Catherine was really instrumental in pushing that whole movement forward that enabled women like me to come along and have a stage and enjoy the career and the joy of running in the same way that men could.
Catherine Switzer. In 1967, she became the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon. Switzer signed her application KV Switzer and was so bundled up at the starting line, race officials didn't know she was a she. During the race, she was tackled by an angry race official, Jock Semple. That famous picture flashed around the world, and Switzer became that pioneer we just heard about. Her book, Marathon Woman, is just out in paperback, so we want to revisit a conversation she had with Alex Ashlock in 2007. She started by reflecting on the day that changed her life.
I was a college kid who really just wanted to come and run that first great race. And I'd been trained by a little mailman at Syracuse University who had run 15 Boston Marathons. And he had told me about every one of them night after night after night in training. And so I was raised on all the heroes of the Boston Marathon. And one day I said to him, I said, well, let's just quit talking about it and run it. And he said, oh, a woman can't run the Boston Marathon. And I said, what do you mean? We're running 10 miles a night in a snowstorm. And he said, well, that doesn't mean that you can run 26 miles. And we argued, and I said, you know, that women throughout history had run the marathon, not many, a half a dozen, and that even Roberta Gibb had run the Boston Marathon in 1966. He just exploded. He said, no dame ever ran the Boston Marathon. But he said, if any woman could do it, I think you could do it. And if you'd prove to me in practice, show me that you could do the distance, I'd even be the first person to take you to Boston.
Tell me about race day.
I was bundled up in a gray sweatsuit, so I looked like one of the guys. But, of course, all the men knew I was a woman, and the officials pushed us into the starting area, and the gun went off, and down the street we went. And 2 miles into the race, the press truck came by, and we were taking pictures and going crazy, seeing a woman in the race wearing numbers. And off the bus, all of a sudden, came Jock Semple in a fury. A woman is in his race, and she's wearing numbers. He clearly thought I was a clown. He thought I was somebody who was making a sacrilege of his wonderful race. He didn't know I had trained. He didn't know I was serious. He just saw red. Went after me, tackled me, and screamed at me, get the hell out of my race and give me those numbers. Try to rip my numbers off. Arnie, my coach, screamed at him, leave her alone. She's okay. I've trained her. And my boyfriend, who only decided to run the Boston Marathon at the last minute because he just happened to be a 235-pound ex-All-American football player, came flying along, threw a cross-body block into Jock, sent Jock flying through the air, and Jock landed on the side of the road, and my coach said, run like hell. And a couple of miles later, when the bus came by again, there was Jock Semple, still in full fury, screaming at us that we were in big trouble and his Scottish broke, and promptly went up to the finish and had me disqualified, not only from Boston, but expelled from the Amateur Athletic Union for a whole bunch of infractions that included running without a chaperone, if you can imagine that, in 1967. But, you know, you can't run 24 miles and stay mad. I spent the next 24 miles of that race trying to figure out what had infuriated him so much. And I knew that Jock was infuriated because he was an overworked race director who loved this race. And he didn't realize that I loved it, too. And he thought I was making a mockery of it. And I was bound and determined to prove to him and the world that I was serious. And I was bound and determined also to create other opportunities for women because I knew that they would be in the race if they had only had the same opportunities that I had. And I knew if I could create events that would welcome them and be non-intimidating, that we could open the doors for women worldwide so that they would have that same sense of self-esteem and accomplishment that I felt.
And you went on to do that with the Avon series and things like that.
I wrote a proposal for Avon Cosmetics, and indeed we took this program on the road to 27 countries for over a million women eventually, and the races led to getting the women's marathon in the Olympic Games. And that took place in 1984. And who could have ever forgotten that moment when Joan Benoit Samuelson came through the Olympic tunnel and into the stadium? They saw that and they said, gosh, women can do anything, which is what we said all along.
You say in your book that you wanted to run Boston because of its history, and you really had no idea that you were going to become part of that history. But after the incident with Jock Semple, you realized you absolutely had to finish this race now, given what had happened.
I had to finish the race, because if I didn't finish it, everybody would say, see, women can't do it, and they're always barging in where they're not welcome. And this was on the eve of the feminist movement, and I had no idea even what feminism was. And suddenly, I was one. And, you know, when I finished the race, I was bound and determined to create other opportunities for women. I often say I started the race as a girl and ended up as a woman.
And 40 years later, you're back in Boston. What does it mean to be back here in this place where you made history?
I haven't missed the Boston Marathon once in the last 40 years. I've been here every single year. On the 40th anniversary, it's extremely special because I'm watching, maybe for the first time, that the fact that women actually are the stars of the race on Monday. And that we've moved in my 40 years, in my lifetime, which I'll tell you has gone like that, we've moved from exclusion to exclusivity. And now with a separate women's start, with the emphasis on women's, it's just absolutely fantastic to see come true what I'd always hoped and dreamed and believed.
I know you remember what your bib number was that day.
Number 261, I'll never forget. I've still got it in my scrapbook, of course, with actually the corner turned off because Jock actually got just the edge of it and ripped the corner off.